Life's really worth living when we are worth giving. Why can't I give some to you?
Yes, I want to be happy. I just once upon a time had a partner who not only liked to ask how happy I was feeling, but also required a quantitative assessment. How many out of 10, she'd ask, as the sun set over the Med or the snow fell on Alabama? Well, even as I admitted to an 8 or 9, I'd inwardly fret about the impossibility of measuring anything so various, so intangible, so elusive as happiness. But such attempts at measurement have become almost commonplace in recent years as social scientists have sought for alternatives to economic growth as a way of evaluating a country's state of well-being. And the latest and perhaps the most comprehensive attempt at the task has come from Danny Dorling, who is the Holford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. Danny approaches the problem by looking at data derived from a large British household panel study, and in particular the slightly offbeat question at the end of this survey. It goes like this: state up to 4 events that happened in the last year which were important to you or your families. Well, most people said nothing significant had happened, but others cited ending or starting a relationship, going on holiday, moving home, or health issues, or the death of a relative. Now, in his next step, Professor Dorling coupled these answers with what the survey also revealed about people's stated sense of their own feeling of happiness. He could then link life events, health, moving house, etc., to relative happiness and therefore discover what mattered most in people's lives and, by extension, what public policies might be enacted which would make them happier, which would make those events which they found sad rather less sad. Well, I'm pleased to say that we can now move beyond that rather schematic outline because I'm joined in the studio by Danny Dorling, the author of a book called A Better Politics, How Government Can Make Us Happy. And also with me I have economist Paul Ormerod, who's visiting professor at University College in London. I've just tried to give a concise account of the data you relied on in writing this book. Is it a fair account?
Yes. I should say, given the early item, that the Better Politics is available for less than £10. And not all academic books are expensive.
They'll allow you the advertisement.
Yeah. What happened with this book is that 10 years ago, with my colleague Demetrius Ballas, we produced an obscure paper for an epidemiology journal, trying to predict the effects of these one-off life events on happiness. And the findings of it have just dogged me in my mind ever since. And I've watched other things being produced. There's a seminal paper in 2010 by Bruce Headley which showed that a long-running German panel survey shows that personal and economic choices, not just genes, matter for happiness. And I thought, well, that fits our results. What we found was that things such as ill health, the deaths of parents, the deaths of other people, splitting up relationships, appear to really dent happiness within a year. And other events appear to boost it, such as births and starting relationships, whereas material things, actually having an expensive holiday, didn't raise happiness that much. And then last year, the Office of National Statistics produced results showing that the amount of wealth people had and their equity in housing and their pensions didn't increase their happiness, but small amounts of saving did, because it allows you a bit of economic freedom.
How does your study fit in with it? I mean, because there has been, there's been an enormous number of studies of happiness in recent years, haven't there? I mean, government have paid attention to it as well. I mean, how does your work fit alongside those other studies of happiness?
Our work differs because we're looking at single events, the key things that might happen to you in a year. We actually find that there are only 34 of these things, of which the least common is passing your driving test. So we think a lot of things happen to us, but in fact you can bunch them together. And it's the things that government could have an influence on. For instance, we have 6,000 children die a year in this country, one of the highest child mortality rates in Europe. It turns out that although child mortality is fairly rare for any of us individually, the effects are so devastating that nationally it would be worthwhile government trying to reduce the number of deaths amongst children purely for the happiness of the nation, let alone that it's a good thing to do. And many common sense things turn out to have a basis in these numbers. For instance, we spend just about the least on our health in Western Europe. The Swiss spend the most, twice as much as us. The Germans spend 50% of us. Given that health-related issues turned out
to be correlated with unhappiness,
correlated with unhappiness so much, why do we, spend the least per head in Western Europe on our health. Although we've got a very efficient NHS, it can only do so much with so little money.
I want to come and examine some of the more findings and some of the policy implications which result from those findings. But let me turn to you, Paul, first of all. I mean, let me ask you, first of all, not about the Danish specific study, but about what might be called, I don't know, happiness economics in general. I mean, you've had a look at years and years, thousands, well, you haven't looked at thousands of articles, but you know there are thousands of articles on this subject. What is your general, as an economist, what is your general evaluation of this investigation into happiness?
Well, I think economists, you know, welcome the development of well-being studies rather than a simple measure of GDP to measure, you know, how well off a country is, because it was never intended. It had a specific purpose when it was constructed, first of all, after the Great Recession of the 1930s. I think there are a couple of points, one of which is for public policy, it might not be terribly useful because we've now got series going back 50 or 60 years on happiness, and it doesn't seem to move very much. The fact is, most of the time, most people are quite happy. So that's one problem which governments have. How do you get to shift it?
So you can have big changes in social conditions, big change, but I think
the main thing which has come out in the last 10 years, because as Danny says, his book is based on a paper he wrote nearly 10 years ago, is that economists have found that the more traditional measure of income is actually very important for happiness. So two Nobel Prize winners, for example, Angus Deaton, who's a British economist, and Danny Kahneman, who's a psychologist, who wrote a very successful book on economic psychology. They make two distinctions, one of which is there's a concept of emotional well-being, which is how people feel on a day-to-day basis, and what they call life evaluation. And they show quite conclusively that life evaluation, the longer run, is correlated with income. The more income people have, the happier they are in general. So in a sense, the two things are starting to come together.
But when people's incomes rise, when they get promotions in the study I look at, their happiness rises less than the fall when their incomes fall. So a more stable society with less precarity, with less people having sudden increases and then decreases in their income, would be a happier society. And the other thing is people adapt very quickly. So in the year of promotion, when your income rises, the rate of happiness rises, but people very quickly adapt to that level of income, which is one reason why the overall happiness level has been flat for all these decades, because our incomes have actually risen over these decades, but our happiness hasn't. I mean, the other very important thing is that there's an incredible balancing between the things that make us unhappy in our lives and the things that make us happy. And overall in our lives, as many bad things as good things tend to happen. So nationally, you wouldn't be surprised that it evens out. But the government could do a lot to mitigate the harm of the bad things and to take into account that these are the things that most seem to affect the welfare of people. Things that people think would make them much happier, for instance, winning the lottery, there's very little evidence that suddenly getting a very large windfall actually improves your conditions very much. Whereas having access to a small amount of savings, not having to borrow money, has a huge effect on people's well-being.
Let me just ask you, Paul, because, I mean, I read your criticism, your statistical criticisms of some of these measurements of happiness, and I can see, you know, I can understand and follow the argument. I wonder if, because Danny's approach is not statistical in that sense. You know, you're not simply sort of looking for correlations between numbers. You're looking for correlations between what people say causes unhappiness and events which have occurred in their life. I mean, do you feel this is a more fruitful approach, or do you still have concerns?
Well, I think all the studies, not just Danny's, but the one I've referred to by Deaton and Kahneman, are based on statistical analysis. If we've got some data on a survey, as you know, if people answer a survey, how do we make sense of it? We have to apply statistical techniques to try to see what the regularities are in that. And I'm saying there that, you know, income 10 years ago, when happiness economics was taking off, there was a so-called paradox, people couldn't find the effect of income. But now more sophisticated studies have taken place that income has been shown to be a key determinant. In fact, only yesterday, the Institute for Fiscal Studies were saying that wealth is an important determinant of well-being. This was in the context of the pensions debate, saying that, you know, if people have some wealth as they get older, they feel much happier, much more secure.
But it's the security, not actually the amount of wealth. It's feeling secure. If it was the amount of wealth, then we'd have an ecstatic set of people in the centre of London who just couldn't stop smiling all the time because they were so wealthy. And you'd go out to the outskirts of the country and you'd find people looking miserable. When you actually look at the geography of happiness, you don't find that. And when you look at the divorce courts for plutocrats, you actually find some terrible lives amongst the very richest. If we look at extreme unhappiness, poor mental health, depression and anxiety, we find international correlations that show from WHO surveys much worse levels of really poor mental health in countries such as the USA and the UK compared to countries which don't have so many of their populations living such precarious and poor lives. The unhappiness that's caused to the poor and the average in unequal countries far outweighs the little bits of extra happiness that a few people gaining a large amount of money win.
Just mention to me, Danny, a couple of the other areas where you feel that public policy might be used to alleviate the consequences of the unhappy events that are happening to people. I think you've mentioned health. I mean, other areas. You talk about death as well, don't you?
We're talking about death and things. We have
jobs.
We have a very high rate of deaths on the road. We could take that as seriously as they take in Sweden. It's not for the person who dies, it's for the people who are left behind that we worry about in this survey. Or what Esther was talking about. Middle-class people, because of long commutes, find it harder to actually come and eat with their parents. Why do we run our country in such a way that so many people have such long commutes? These are some of the longest commutes in Western Europe. Why do we organise London so that people cannot live near where they work as they do in many other large cities in Europe? Why don't we have a public transport system like other European countries have, which works better rather than having people sitting in cars getting frustrated and getting back home at night at 8 or 10 o'clock in the night, long after their children have gone to bed? Other countries which show higher rates of happiness through a series of studies from economists I've got in the front of the book organise their societies in ways that allow family life to work better. You cannot do that yourself. You cannot paint your own cycle lane on a road.
Now, Paul, I mean, you might want to... I mean, you expressed a number of concerns about the idea of using happiness as a base. I mean, this doesn't mean to say that you are happy to talk about GDP as a measure of a country's well-being
at
all.
It's a reasonable indication, but if I could mention two non-economic factors which have been found to be, you know, really quite decisive in people's happiness. One of which is having religious faith seems to be a strong determinant of people's happiness. And the other is that not all family structures are equal as far as happiness is concerned. The evidence that being married from the scientific literature on this is quite decisive. People who are married on average are happier than people who say cohabiting or in single relationships. So there are two clearly non-economic factors which I think the happiness literature showed to be quite decisive in improving people's happiness.
But it depends how you look at it. The way I look at it is just what happened to you in the last year, and you find that people who've split up are very unhappy. Now, of course, those studies are including people who've just split up, whereas the people who are married, almost by definition, haven't split up, although, of course, you have people in unhappy marriages.
Well,
there are different ways of looking at exactly the same survey data, and if you look at the same data with a different mindset, you draw different conclusions.
Well, I think the point here, Danny, is, I mean, you've written, it's an interesting book, it's an interesting paper. Yours is just one paper. There are hundreds and thousands of papers which have appeared since then, including the ones out by, you know, by Deaton and Kahneman. And these are findings, you know, across the literature. These are very strong findings. So they're not just on a single paper.
Yeah.
That marriage and religious faith,
but this is by economists. Also psychologists which have looked at happiness, and they disagree with the economists. It's not surprising that when economists look at happiness, they tend to find that income is very important. When psychologists look at happiness, they find that income is much less important.
Well, Danny Kahneman is probably the most famous psychologist in the world, and it was he who wrote the book with the article
I mean,
with Angus Deaton.
Just to add one little thing, I mean, you point out that even though things which happen in society, which might seem... which would suggest greater happiness, don't seem to have any effect upon those statistically calculated measures of happiness. So that, for example, improvements in gender relations, I mean, feminist improvements in working conditions and so on, these don't seem to show up in any shift
in happiness.
Well, perhaps I could, you know, satisfy Daniel by reverting to a caricature of an economist of the type and saying one of the problems, I mean, we have to use surveys for happiness, but economists are always quite sceptical and suspicious of what people say in surveys. And economists like to judge people by their actions. See, I remember, like you will, Laurie, I remember the 1980s, when in survey after survey, people said they wanted more public expenditure to pay, and they would pay higher taxes. And election after election, they returned Mrs. Thatcher to power.
Well, I think we... I mean, a last very quick word, Danny.
They did, and I think they now regret it. The middle class are the elderly in Britain now, the ones who lived into their 80s. And one thing I describe in A Better Politics is how we've had a huge absolute rise in death amongst people over 80 who disproportionately voted for Margaret Thatcher.
And that is the last word. And, oh, anyway, we've got one little cynical thrust from Edith Wharton, who wrote, "If only we'd stop trying to be happy, we could have a pretty good time."
I won't be happy till I make you happy too.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that programme. And if you'd like to hear something similar, why not try downloading the In Our Time podcast at bbc.co.uk/radio4.